So today we shall be starting this text called the Kaivalya Upanishad. We won't actually do this text today, I'll just do an introduction to the subject. The Upanishads are part of the Vedas. The Vedas are the spiritual textbooks of the Hindus. And their origin dates to several thousand years before Christ. So today I shall just talk a little bit about the Vedas and what they contain, and then next week we'll get into the subject of the Upanishad. So today you won't be needing the text. So in the introduction, the Vedas come from the root vid. Vid means to know. That's the Sanskrit root, vid, and there are a lot of words, you know, related to vid, vidya, vidyavan, and things like that. So that means to know. So Vedas are book of instructions, and we find that in the world we need instructions everywhere. If you buy a computer, or if you buy a TV, or nowadays these fancy HD and all that, they all come with instructions. Most of us, of course, don't read them and just try to operate directly. Oh, I know, especially the man of the house, he never reads instructions. But we are supposed to, because then only when you get stuck, then you know how to operate that piece of equipment. Even a matchbox, they actually comes with the instruction, fold it here and strike that, you know. So even something as simple as that comes with instructions. If you need to drive, then again, you know, there are instructions, there are rules, you know, stop sign, traffic light, speed limit, you know, the rules of the road. So they come with instructions. If you buy a new car, it tells you, you know, how to start the car, how to operate, what are the things to look for, troubleshoot and all. So Vedas are our book of instructions which tell us how to live. And all the scriptures of the world do that. The Bible, the Quran, the Torah of the Jews, the book of Confucius. All of these give us instructions about how to live our life. The do's and don'ts, you know, the Ten Commandments, the definite instructions. So the Vedas are the book that contain instructions on how to live our life, what to do, what not to do. And the Vedas are four. I won't go into the details, but it's called Rig Veda, Sam Veda, Yajur Veda, and Atharva Veda. The Rig Veda is the largest and the most ancient. And then these came about subsequently. The Vedas actually were not composed by one author, unlike the Bible, which has Jesus, ascribed to Jesus, or Quran, Muhammad, Dharmapada, Buddha. The Vedas were composed by various rishis, various ascetics, various monks and saints, over a period of a few thousand years. So it is the composite knowledge of a variety of realized masters, variety of very evolved masters who contributed to this book, like the Vedas, like the physics. Is there one person who contributed to physics? No. Einstein and Oppenheimer and, you know, so many physicists, Galileo, and over the years, we find that different physicists came and contributed, Archimedes. So over the years, and then we find modern physicists, some of the Einstein's theories, now they are finding that, you know, there are modifications. So just as physics does not have one author, does not have one teacher, one guru, so same with the Vedas do not have one author. So if you ask who is the author of the Vedas, several hundred scholars, maybe even more than that, contributed at different times. And they are called Shrutis. Why are the Vedas called Shrutis? Because They were not composed by human mind. Shruti means heard. So what these great masters, when they sat in deep meditation and their mind was completely still, in the stillness of their meditation, these words were revealed to them. So they were directly in contact with the higher source. You can call it God or Brahman or Father in heaven or the reality. And so in their meditation, these verses were revealed to them by the higher reality. And then what they did was they remembered them. And then they then told those to their teachers, to the students. The teachers told to their students and the students remembered them. In those days, there was no written word. So it was passed on from teacher to student by memory. Students had to remember and they had to memorize entire books, entire texts, thousands of verses, everything they had to memorize and pass it on to their students. And then a few thousand years later came Vedavyas, who was the author of, not the Vedas, but what he did was he organized them. He found out that there were too many scattered teachings, too many masters, and it was hard to memorize as life gets more complicated. Like nowadays, you know, previously we used to memorize all phone numbers. I had phone number, at least 200 or 300 phone numbers memorized of my referring doctors, family, children. Now I don't remember a single one. Why? Because the phone is there. So your memory gets, as the modern world comes, we stop using our brain. We use it less and less. You know, I used to remember directions. Now you don't need to, just Google it or put the maps or history. We were telling one student he should come to the, you know, Bal Vihar, our children's classes. So he said, why should I come? My wife was talking to him. So she said, you know, you can learn about Ramayana, Mahabharata, all our great epics. You can learn about our the gods and all about. He said, why do I need to learn about epics? I can just Google it. I don't need to go to. So after a while, that's what's going to happen. People are not even going to bother to go to school or college to learn everything. They just Google. So the point is that he felt, Vedvyas, that this knowledge was so vast, it was hard for people to memorize. So he organized them into four Vedas and he also put them to writing. They were written so that they became a permanent record. So that's how the Vedas were organized, and they are called Shrutis because they were heard. They were not, some person didn't sit down and compose them. What they heard in their meditation, they then reproduced it. And the knowledge of the Vedas is unlike the other instructions, you know, instructions about computer and cars and so on. This knowledge takes us beyond this world. Whatever we see, hear, smell, taste and touch, the physical sciences will tell us about the properties of matter and, you know, the laws of energy in physics. In chemistry, we learn about the, you know, the different elements and molecules. In biology, we learn about plants and, you know, zoology and botany and all. So in economics, politics, they all teach you about this world. But the religious scriptures take us beyond this world. Not only what you see, hear, smell, taste, touch, what you can feel and experience, but what is higher than all this? What is beyond this world? What is it that created this world? How did this world come into being? What is my relationship in this world? Why am I here? What is my relationship to God? And who is that creature called God or reality or a supreme entity? That supreme being is described in the Vedas. And it tells us about dharma. Dharma means what is my duty. Dharma, of course, has many meanings. It can be meant as religion. But here, dharma means it tells us what is our duty. And that is the most important knowledge of all the scriptures, that what am I supposed to do, what am I not supposed to do. So that is what the Vedas teach us. Then there are sub-Vedas. Now, Vedas would deal with this highest knowledge, and then there were other Vedas which deal with science, grammar, even medicine. Ayurveda, you must have heard of. Ayurveda is the science of medicine. which can cure a lot of illnesses with the use of herbs and such herbal medicines. They knew about astronomy, they knew about astrology, they knew about the movement of the stars and the planets, and they had described the planets and how they move in space. And this is a few thousand years, you know, before Galileo or Copernicus, you know, talked about, you know, because until then they used to believe that, you know, Earth is the center of the universe and everything revolves around it. But our ancient masters, few thousand years ago, knew about the movement of the planets and the revolution. And then how that affects the astrology, how it can, you know, they could very accurately predict how this person's life is going to be. And then the medicines they use, even today, a lot of the chronic illnesses can be cured by Ayurveda and so on. And then they had very complicated grammar. Actually, Sanskrit is the most complicated, but at the same time, the most precise language in the world. And the Sanskrit is said to be the origin of the world's languages. A lot of the European languages owe their origin to Sanskrit, like mother, you know, in Sanskrit is matra, in English is mother, in Spanish is madre, in German is mutter. So a lot of the, if you look at it, a lot of the, of course, the Chinese language developed separately, and, you know, the Asian languages, but a lot of the Western languages and Sanskrit have a lot of things in common, German and all. So they had very advanced grammar. Now the Vedas consist of three portions. The first one is called the mantras or brahmanas. The second portion is called upasanas. And the third portion is called jnana or knowledge, which is the Upanishad. So we won't do the third portion today, that we shall do next week. But the first portion of the Upanishads are called mantras and brahmanas. Some people split them into two, mantras being separate, brahmanas being separate, and then three and four. Some people say four portions, some people say three portions. Put these as one, put both these together. It doesn't matter. But the brahmanas mostly deal with rituals. Rituals mean there were very specific rituals in those days, where if you wanted, say if you wanted a son, they could do specific rituals, and, you know, they said you could have a son. If you wanted it to rain, and there was, I think maybe now we should find out how they can do that. But they could do specific rituals. Actually, one of the Swamijis who came from India did suggest one ritual. And he said, if you know a Pandit who can do that, Varuna ritual, it can, you know, make it rain. But anyway, so they could do those specific rituals for specific purposes. And then also rituals were meant to purify the mind, to remember God, and in general, you know, to purify the house, to make the house. So they would invite a priest who would come and do the rituals, light a fire, and then offer prayers and offer oblations. So specific rituals were done for specific purposes or for general purification of the mind. Then mantras deal with karmas, means what I should do. What are my duties? Karmas, as we know, means action. And without action, we cannot live. We all need to act. In fact, a week from this Sunday, we will be speaking at the Center for, what's that, Spiritual Learning?
CSL.
Yeah, I will be there. I will be talking on karma and karma yoga. So what are activities and what are karma yoga activities dedicated to Lord? So that is the topic on the 12th. So here, karmas means actions, means what I should do. And they divided them into three and then a fourth one. First one is nitya or daily duties. Daily duties means what I should do every day. What is my duty in life? So like I have to get up in the morning, take a shower, have my breakfast and go to work. And we all need to work. Either some people work in the office, or some people work in the home, or some people, you know, work in the garden. So work we have to do to maintain our life, to, you know, to earn and so on. But not only our duty is to take care of me and my family, but my duty extends beyond that. I have to take care of my older parents. I have to take care of my children who cannot take care of themselves. Then it is my duty to support spiritual and religious organizations, charitable organizations, organizations that take care of blind children, and, you know, handicapped, and Red Cross. So all those are my duties. So work I have to do. Without work, you know, person says, I'm so rich, I'm so comfortable, I don't need to work. But even to maintain your life, you need to do some work. You need to get up and have breakfast, you need to work. Talking about work, this man asks his boss, he says, sir, tomorrow I need the day off. So he says, why do you need the day off? He says, sir, my wife has scheduled a heavy day tomorrow. She wants me to clean out the attic, clean out the garage, and there is a lot of heavy things I have to move and a lot of work I have to do. So boss says, you know, we are very short-handed. I can't give you the day off. He said, thank you, sir. I knew I could count on you. So duties we have to perform. These are called nitya or daily duties, and these are my responsibilities to myself, my family. I have to take care of my physical health. I have to exercise. I have to take care of my emotional health. I have to take care of my intellectual health, read good books. And I have to take care of my spiritual health by growing spiritually. So nitya karma. Then there is naimitya karma or special activities. Besides daily activities, there are special activities like somebody is getting married. You know, so you're invited, so you go for the wedding and you offer your congratulations. Or somebody passed away, so you go to his, you know, to his ceremony, and then you offer your condolences. A graduation party or a Christmas, you know, when there is, you know, a lot of parties. 4th of July, now there will be so many barbecues. So these are my special duties. So when I get invited to a wedding or a graduation, I go there and do my duties. Then there are kamya or desire prompted activities. So these are activities that I do for a specific desire. Desire could be good or desire could be bad. You know, a thief also works. But a thief works why? So that he can steal more money, so he can live a comfortable life. And a saint also works. But his desire is not personal. A saint's desire is for the benefit of mankind. May I serve others, may I spread this knowledge. All the great prophets and scholars, they work, but they did not even have a desire to serve. They had this knowledge from the Lord and they just spontaneously wanted to share it. So their activity was desireless, but you can start with a desire to serve the world, to make the world a better place. So the desires can be selfish or can be unselfish. And then ultimately, you act out of love, spontaneous love for all mankind, and you share this knowledge. And then activities also depend on my station in life, like a student. A student has certain duties. Student has to study, do well in his studies, and, you know, pass so that he can get a good job. And then once a person becomes a householder, then he has to, you know, his duties are different. His or her duties are duties towards the family, towards the community. And then as we get older, once you are reaching retirement, then your duties become different. Then you are supposed to withdraw. So they say that it is called a stage of withdrawal. As you pass 50 and 60, then you slowly say, okay, now I have to stop interfering in activities of my children and grandchildren. Let them do what they are doing. If they need my help, I will help. But I have to think about my own spiritual growth. So slowly, as you become more comfortable in life, you withdraw from the world and spend more time in spiritual pursuit. It doesn't mean that when I'm young, I don't do that. When I'm young, I still have to spend some time in meditation, in study, in spiritual pursuits. But as I grow older, slowly, slowly you withdraw from the world and detach. And your full-time duty should be spiritual growth, spiritual unfoldment. So these mantras and brahmanas tell us about rituals, tell us about our duties, what we should do, what we should not do. Everything is described in great detail. The Vedas are, you know, thousands and thousands of verses. What I am giving you is a very, very brief introduction. There is so much can be said about it, but we don't need to go into details. The idea is just to see what is in these textbooks. The next portion of the Vedas is called Upasana or worship. There they used to worship nature. In those days they would worship the sun god, the god of the wind, the god of rain, Indra, the god of the oceans. So the natural forces were worshipped because again they wanted to invoke the grace. Like you said, if you wanted to rain, and the sun because it gives us energy. So a lot of the prayers in the Rig Veda were directed towards sun god. You know, Gayatri mantra and all those, you know, all these chants were directed that the sun that illumines the whole universe, may it illumine my intellect. So that was. And so through worship of these individual gods, later on, of course, then gods came with form. You know, then later on, they introduced gods with form, you know, like you see some of them on the walls here, gods and goddesses. But originally, they used to worship nature, which was formless, not a particular form. But then again, the mind does not dwell on the form. It does not dwell on the formless. So worship of the form came about. And this worship led to the worship of the total being, the total consciousness, the Brahman, the God, the Brahman, the Father in heaven, the substratum of this universe, which directs the activities of all the other natural forces, whether it's God of wind or sun or moon or rain or fire, because even the fire was worshipped. So the idea is that there is one entity which we call Brahman, which is a substratum, the total being. And so the prayers were ultimately directed to that who is everything, who is also within me as consciousness. And then the prayers can be, as I mentioned, random or directed. One is just, you know, just for purification of the mind. When you remember God, your mind becomes pure, your mind becomes peaceful, you have less jealousy, greed, hatred, and so on, because you are invoking. The moment you remember Lord, your mind becomes peaceful. Or they were directed prayers, like you say, okay, God, I need a child. I don't have a child, or my child needs to pass the exam, or my child is sick, or my company is not doing well, I'm not making enough. So prayers can be random or they can be directed. But the main benefit of prayer is it purifies the mind, connects our mind with the higher. And then what it does, once you invoke the Lord's grace, then what happens is that whatever activities are assigned to me, wherever station I am in, whatever job I am supposed to do, I do it without likes or dislikes. It's not that I like this work, so I do it. I don't like this work. It is God's work. Whether I am an engineer or a doctor or a housewife or a student or wherever I am, retired, I do my duties as a dedication to the Lord without likes and dislikes. As an instrument, so then the doership gets less, the ego gets less, the arrogance gets less. And you offer all your activities to God. He is the one working through me. I am a humble instrument. I am a servant in His hands. With that attitude, when we work, when it reduces your ego, the activity also becomes more pure. When you're doing His work, God's work, then you cannot have anger or greed or jealousy or hatred. So some people, even in spiritual work, they get that. But then they have not understood the meaning of spirituality. True spirituality should reduce your ego, make you more humble, make you more dedicated to the higher and give it to Him. And what one understands, that duty comes first. So as through all of these, what we understand is that there is a place I have been stationed, which is determined by my past karmas, by my past desires, and there is a higher being that controls everything. There is a law of karma which decides you know, whatever good I do, I will get good results. Whatever bad I do, I'll get bad results. So I do my duty without doership, without the sense of I or mine, dedicated to the higher, and such an activity purifies the mind. And this is in brief what the Vedas contain. And then the last portion of the Vedas is called the Upanishads. That's why this Kevalya Upanishad. Upanishad means it's the knowledge part. And this again is a very lengthy subject. So this we shall study next week. What do we mean by Upanishad? What is the path of knowledge? And what is the meaning of Kevalya? And what does this? And then we will dive into this. It's a very, very beautiful text. A few years back we had covered it, but I actually at that time I myself didn't. I don't know how good a job I did, I'm not sure. But I thought that this is something a lot of new people are there, and this text is directly related to meditation. It talks about the need for meditation, the technique of meditation, what is the goal of meditation, what is the obstacles and what are the purposes of. It's a very, very beautiful text. And then the second half of this text takes us very high to who am I, what is my true nature, and what we heard from Swami Tejomayananda Guruji in the past 4 days, especially on the last day. Those of you who came on the last day, he went into the highest knowledge, and that will be expanding in more detail as to what is this world and what is my relationship. So this text will help us to not only improve our meditation, but focus the meditation on its goal, on its purpose. So it's a very, very useful text, and I'm looking forward to covering it with all of you. Any questions or comments about what we have talked about today, or anything in general? Right. Well, what he said was what meditation is and what meditation is not. See, we think of meditation as it is an activity, something I have to do. You know, I have to do, I have to sit and meditate. But what the rishis have done is through doing, they have taken us to not doing. So like they say, what should I do? You know, we have always go to the teacher. He says, okay. If he tells the student, do nothing, he'll say, what kind of instruction is this? What do you mean by do nothing? He'll say, okay, sit erect. So you sit erect. Don't move your hands, and you know, put your hands on your knee, okay? And keep your back straight, okay? Keep your eyes closed. And for the next 20 or 30 minutes, don't move. So he has given you instruction, do this, but in the process of doing it, you are not doing anything. When you are not moving, and what is happening? Your back is erect. So he is, you know, don't move your body, don't walk around. So through doing, they have taken you to non-doing. Then he says, okay, now you breathe, and you know, you relax your body, and you chant the mantra. So what is again the mind, which is doing a lot of things? Through the chanting of the mantra, through breath observation, it is being brought to one thought. That is the sound of the mantra or the sound of or the breath. So the mind, which was thinking all these various thoughts, is now brought to one thought. And then they say, oh, be a witness of the thought and do not let the mind wander. So as soon as the mind wanders to work or to business or to my family, say, bring it back and focus your mind inward. So through doing, even the mind is first stilled, the body is stilled, the breath, they say, you know, breath which is erratic is controlled. So through all these activities, the person comes to a state of stillness. Physical stillness, mental stillness, emotional stillness, intellectual stillness. So the mind is not thinking, the body is not moving. And in that silence, in that, then they direct you inward. And to who am I, what is my real nature? And then they say, from the body, mind and intellect, turn your attention to the knower, to the consciousness, and abide in that knowledge. And that's why he said meditation is not only to be done. Somebody asked Swami Chinmayananda, how long should I meditate? every day. He said only 24 hours. 24 hours a day you should be meditating. So what they mean is that this process of meditation should not only end when you get up from your meditation seat, but you should all the time be aware of the inner silence, the inner self, and be a witness and a part of your part of you should be aware of my, I should be aware of my body, my mind, my intellect. So you should become a witness of your thoughts. So at every given moment you should know who am I and what do I know. So anything that I own, I am not. Like my body, you know, like they say, it is my pen, my watch, my shirt. If it's my pen, I am not the pen. My car, I am not the car. My shirt, I am not the shirt. So when I say my body hurts, that means I am the owner of the body. I am not the body. The moment you say my car is broken, then I am not the car. My watch is working, I am not the watch. So my body is hurting and I am not the body. My mind is upset. My intellect is confused. The moment I and my come, the moment my comes, then I become the owner of the body, mind and intellect. And you turn your attention to who is the owner. So that abidance, firm abidance, constant abidance, understanding of that is meditation is basically the goal of meditation. I don't know if anything else, anybody else remembers. This is how much I got from the talk. So that is what is meditation, what is the purpose and what is the goal? To abide in the Om, the consciousness, and constantly remember that. And this text, the second half, goes into very much detail of who am I and takes you and constantly how you can abide in that knowledge. It's a very, very beautiful text. So in brief, I guess this is what he covered, unless somebody else remembers anything else. Yeah, constant awareness that there is this higher entity that is making me function. And through practice, through detachment, what happens is we are so engrossed in the world and what we see, hear, smell, taste, and we forget who is the one behind the eye, who is behind the mind. And so being constantly aware of my inner self, abiding in that knowledge, constantly remembering that, constantly understanding it. That is not meditation. Prayer is not meditation. In prayer, you are asking God, okay, God, I am sick and heal my illness. That is, prayer is not meditation. Meditation is abidance in my true self. I am that. That understanding is meditation. In that, there is no prayer, there is no beseeching, there is no other. See, in prayer, there is another, okay, there is this almighty God and I am asking him. But in meditation, you realize that there is only one entity, that is everything. We'll talk in more detail in the next. Swamiji also talked about the cause and the effect. We don't have time to go into that today. That is another subject. Maybe next week, if I have time, I can talk, answer your question about cause and effect. And what is this world? And it will be coming in the text also. But yeah, so abiding in that knowledge that there is one higher entity that has appeared as this whole universe. Everything is that, and I am also that. So there is no prayer, there is no beseeching in that. No, not in meditation. In meditation, you don't pray to God. You can go to a temple or a church and sit, lie, kneel before God and pray for it. That's okay, you know, for my father or my child or my... But not in meditation. In meditation, you have no thoughts. You try to still the thoughts. And there's only one thought of who am I.
But in meditation, you're going towards
non-duality, oneness, Advaita. That there is no two. There is one alone. In this. Everything is him. Everything is that. I am also that. He's also that. She's also that. Even the chair is that. Everything is that consciousness.
I think what Swamiji said, you stretch my heart.
Sure, yeah, people whom we deal with, yeah, because absolutely, when everything is me, everything is one, how can I, like, I cannot say I hate my right leg, I love my left leg. No, I love them both equally. Even if one is hurting, I'll go to the doctor, try to get it well. So similarly, I cannot hate anything because they are all me. in the path of duality, devotion, you can say that this Almighty God has created everybody and we are all His children. He and she and him and Hindu, Muslim, everybody is the child of God. So that is the path of duality. You know, where this, I love everybody as brother and sister or as my fellow beings, as children of God. But in that highest, you say that alone is expressing as everything. So me and everything else are one, right? But the end result is the same, universal love. That's what all the saints taught us. Yeah. So the one who notices is not the mind, right? If I am watching, like if I'm watching the mirror, I'm not the mirror. If I'm watching the window, I'm not the window. If I'm watching the tree, I'm not the tree. So if I'm watching the mind, then I am not the mind. I am the watcher. So the watcher is the Om, the ultimate consciousness. Because what happens is that detaching yourself from the mind is the best way. Suppose your mind is very upset, you know, very agitated. Some bad news came or somebody hurt me or somebody insulted me. You can let yourself get drowned in that sorrow. You know, oh, I am so miserable. I am so unfortunate. Or you can stand as a witness and say, yes, my mind has been hurt. You know, my emotions have been hurt. And so you watch, okay, the mind at this moment is hurt. 2 hours ago, the mind was happy. And then 1 hour ago, it was agitated. So one who can stand back and watch the flow of thoughts in the mind does not get overwhelmed by the mind. Is able to see the fluctuation, and that is the very fastest way to get out of grief, sorrow, stress, anger, jealousy, any of the disturbances of the mind can otherwise overwhelm us. I know the river example I have given many times, but you know, the river is flowing, like the, of course, nowadays we don't have any water in the Kern River, but when we used to have water, Kern River is so strong that if I step in that, I'll get pulled and I'll get drowned, I'll get totally, you know, killed. But if I can stand on the banks of the river and watch the flow of the river, the mighty Kern is flowing, then I can enjoy the beauty of the flow without getting involved in it. So similarly, just as the river is a flow of water, and without the flow of water, there's not a river. Suppose you say there is no flowing water and it's a stationary water, then you don't call it a river, you call it a lake or a pond or a swimming pool. But water that is flowing is called river. So similarly, thoughts that are flowing are called the mind. If the thoughts are still, then there is no mind. So the movement of thoughts is the mind. So just as a river is a flow of water, mind is a flow of thoughts. So if you let the mind overtake you, if you get caught in the flow of the thoughts, then your mind takes you over and then you are gone. Then you are stressed out and then you taking drugs or committing suicide or, you know, taking a gun and shooting others. Why? Because these people, their mind has, you know, taken them over. But a wise person can stand as a silent witness and watch the flow of thoughts and say, okay, today my mind is happy, tomorrow will be unhappy, third day will be agitated, but I am the witness, I am none of those. So that is the way to overcome stress. And that is what we practice in meditation, to watch the flow of thoughts and concentrate on who knows, who is the knower of the thoughts. Yes, yes. That would be the consciousness. And ultimately, the thoughts become still. A watched mind becomes a quiet mind. Once you are aware of the thoughts, and then in that silence, then you experience the inner peace, the inner bliss. And then there are certain verses which we will cover in the later part of the Upanishads, which will talk about who is this I? Who is this I? What does it do? Who am I really? What is my true nature? And that way they will go into a lot of detail. The last half of the Upanishad talks about this I. Or a thief. You know, if there's a thief, he's trying to steal, but if he sees a police car there, or a policeman walking, he'll become very quiet and become very nice. The moment the policeman leaves, then he'll start his mischief. So similarly, the mind that is watched starts behaving.